All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters, what the fucking ears, what the fuckaholics, what the fucktopians? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show, WTF the Podcast. As you can tell, I might have a little nasal issue. I don't like it. And it was my birthday yesterday. It's my fucking birthday, and I was sick on my birthday. But I wasn't immersed in a nightmare of drama and horror like my 50th birth. Oh, wait. It's going to happen. Oh, God. Oh, God. What a good feeling that is. Oh, my God. How great are sneezes when they happen? When the buildup is just like it was, you heard it, just a little bit of buildup, and then bam, delivers the goods. And you get that wonderful feeling. How fucking pathetic is this? How pathetic is it? A sober dude, and I'm sitting here celebrating the buzz of a fucking sneeze. Wow. Right? Look, I know that some of you already know this, but we got some... we have new news and just a reiteration of some other news. You already know that the WTF archives are now on Howl Premium. You know that. Well, guess what? The Howl app for Android is officially here. We got it. And to celebrate, Howl is giving you a chance to win a piece of my garage. I'm going to take a little saw or a knife or something and cut off a piece. And I'm going to take photos of me doing it. And I'll sign the piece. And we'll have an official certificate of authenticity that you have a piece of my garage. So if you're a premium subscriber and you haven't gotten this news yet, just go to WTF.howl.fm and enter your email address. Even if you're on a free trial, anyone who's subscribed can enter to win a piece of the garage. If you use Howl on Android, iPhone, or on your desktop, if you want to become a new premium subscriber, go to howl.fm and use the promo code WTF at checkout. Howl Premium is the only way to access all the WTF archives, whether you are on an iPhone or an Android or using the web. And if you're already a WTF Premium subscriber and haven't transferred your account to Howl yet, you can do it today. Your price and plan stay exactly the same. Check your email to see if the transfer instructions that Howl sent came and they're in your inbox, or send an email to support@howl.fm. Fucking piece of the garage. Where am I going to find that? I want to give you a real piece, though. A real piece of the fucking garage. We have a kind of a mixed bag of a show today. I've got Jake Kasdan, who's a film director, also the executive producer of The Grinder. That's a new comedy with Rob Lowe. It's going to premiere on Fox tomorrow night. His dad is Lawrence Kasdan, writer of Star Wars and many other things. Body Heat, one of my favorite movies. And, you know, Lawrence Kasdan is sort of a mythic presence here in the show business. And Jake is his son, who directed a couple of movies in his own right. And I ran into him in New York once, and we talked for a bit. I'm like, you should come on the show. So here he is on the show. Also, in a few minutes, a repeat guest for a quick chat, Fred Stoller. Always engaging and entertaining to talk to Mr. Stoller. He'll be up soon. But what about life, man? I'm 52 years old. I have a lot to be grateful for. Thank you for all the birthday greetings. Thank you for listening. I am grateful. I'm happy to provide this show for you. I do need to figure out what I enjoy doing, and I do need to learn how to relax. And I do have a fantasy of disappearing. But you know what the problem with disappearing is? Disappearing. Terrifying. What if you really disappear? What if you know, no one really cares if you come back? Oh, that seems like, you know, parent stuff. That seems like some issues. So Fred Stoller always makes me happy. Fred's book, Maybe We'll Have You Back, The Life of a Perennial TV Guest Star, is available now wherever you get books. Fred also has a podcast, The Mild Adventures of Fred Stoller. You can go to fredstoller.net for everything Fred Stoller. And I love when he comes by. This is me and Fred Stoller.
It was this farmer's market table, you know, with Paul Mazursky.
Who right. Died.
So after doing your podcast, people started showing up and sitting down.
Just people.
because I mentioned.
So Fred Stoller is back in the garage talking. I don't know why I'm introducing like that. I never do that.
I thought you were saying, I don't know why he's here again.
No.
There's this table at the farmer's market. Paul Mazursky passed away. But you were saying, like, what do you do during the day?
Right.
Like, what's your routine? Do you have one? And the only real one I had was there's this morning table of the late Paul Mazursky, George Segal. All these people would sit there. Jack Riley, character actors. And I go, I sort of sit at the end, like the children's table, because I'm sort of with people, but don't have to interact.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then this people would just sit down. They would just say, oh, there's the table. And I heard it on Marc Maron. People go, who are you? He goes, oh, I heard you on WTF. And George Segal's a very private person, so they got mad at me.
And then what'd they do? Did they have to move the table?
Well, no, it didn't happen. There was one guy, he brought a really pretty girl, his girlfriend, so he kind of used that. And she was flirting with everyone.
And they wedged themselves into the conversation? Yeah.
Well, they were just sitting there and like staring at
people.
Like
it was like a show.
Yes, yes.
We're here for the show.
Yes, yes. So, sadly, Paul Mazursky died, but then the table revolved around his dialysis schedule.
Yeah.
It used to be every day.
Yeah.
But then it was just Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And then he died. So people like Quentin Tarantino, Sharon Stone wouldn't come. You know, all these people would come to the table because of Paul Mazursky.
Right.
And so then he died, and now it's just 2 days a week.
And who's there now?
Who's there now? A guy, Charlie Bragg, who's famous for being a painter to the stars. Mm-hmm. He sells paintings. There's one person, I won't mention his name. He's an actor, but he won't look me in the eye. It's so. I never was one of these guys at the Comedy Cellar who would sit there with Colin and argue about race relations. Fuck you. So there's one guy, I won't mention his name. He's a very aggressive comedian. Uh-huh. You know him. And they like to argue. So
you just sit there frightened?
I don't like being isolated. So right. I sit like at a table to the side, so it feels like I'm with people, but I'm not in the mix. You know what I mean? Like the children's table, so right. I'm not alone.
You're just a quiet guy at the end.
Yes, I'm not committed to it.
So when did you write this, Maybe We'll Have Your Back book?
Well, actually, the thing was, I had this in the making for like 10 years.
And it's a memoir.
It's a memoir. See, I think, I don't know if you're a sports guy.
Not really. Not, like not a at Jay all, Moore actually. Kind of it's guy. All right.
Okay. But I like following people. I used to love what's called garbage time. I'm not saying I'm a garbage time player. When they're up by 30, they throw in these guys and I'm rooting for them. Yeah. Oh, this guy gets to make a basket. Or people. So I felt like being a sitcom actor, I've never been a regular. So I always was attracted to stories of people, excuse me, that what it's like going from show to show, the guy, like a foster kid, going from show to show, hoping one keeps me on. You know what I mean?
Right.
So I had this idea when I was doing a lot more guest spots, because, you know, I've been on Seinfeld, Raymond, what it's like walking on eggshells, which stars are assholes to you, who lets you eat lunch with them.
Right.
I thought that's interesting. So then many years ago, I wrote up a draft. And this is before PDFs.
Right.
So then I'd get a lead on a literary agent.
Yeah.
And I'd send them and I'd print it up. You know, I have to do double space.
Yeah, yeah.
And go to Kinko's. And it would cost me $40 to send. And they'd say things like, it's not gritty enough. Because, you know, they want 30 days in rehab. I masturbate on kids in the street. And mine's just a guy who walks around the Grove.
Sits at the end of a table and doesn't talk.
Yeah. Well, I'm really selling the book. But, one of them was interested, but he said he wanted a happier ending. Because I didn't have that. Oh, now I'm a regular on, you know, Parks and Recreation.
Now I talk at the table.
Yes. And one of them actually said, we wish there was more sex. And then a joke, it's me too, you know, because it's not, you know. So then I sat in my computer because I kind of gave up, you know.
Not right.
gave up. I said, maybe one day I'll really be famous and I'll have memoirs. But then, with PDFs, I was able to send it around without it costing $60. And people said, this is kind of interesting. I said, yeah, I'm not so much the perennial guest star guy anymore. You know, I said, these are still good shows. So someone had a lead, something called Kindle Singles. Have you heard of it? Well, besides me?
No.
Okay, it's really, really, it got big because it's these, on Amazon, these books.
Right,
mini
you
books.
Just put them right on the Kindle and you can self-publish.
No, but I was lucky because I the editor where it's on Amazon's main page.
Right.
So anyone could do it, but this is, hey, these are the ones Amazon likes.
Oh, right.
So it was called My Seinfeld Year. I just siphoned off the chapter about what it was like writing on Seinfeld for a season.
So that was from the book that you had been working on.
Yes.
Okay.
I sent the guy the book.
Right.
He goes, this is funny. It's sad. It's good. But how could this be a single? Then I thought, oh, the Seinfeld chapter stands alone.
Right.
What it was like trying to maneuver with Jerry and Larry. And they did a nice cover, and it did really well. So someone helped me get a literary agent, and then I buffed it up. And then I got all the same rejections, like, who cares about a guy who's, you don't know, you sort of know his face. I was getting these emails that are, like, really putting me down. Like, we think the Seinfeld is all he's got. One of them said, I'm glad Fred Stiller had his moment in the sun, but we don't see this as a book. And actually, because you're a podcast, I got a marketplace. And,
it
did well. So then it was funny, as I was getting rejections, I was buffing it up. All right. So then I forgot I had a one-night stand with Kathy Griffin. So I put that in. That's the sexual stuff. She wanted to punch me.
That's the big seller. That's the big pitch. I found one.
I found a celebrity.
Sad fucking sexual experience.
Yes, exactly. A very sad one. And so then I got some publisher and...
Did you thank Kathy?
I should have. I'm thanking her.
Remember
now.
Remember that horrible night?
Well, the funny thing is that she, you know, I don't know if I want to go, this lunatic sued me and stuff. But all the people I was afraid of could care less. Like, she went on Howard Stern and somehow Stern heard about this, said... This guy, who's a schmuck, you know, he's saying you slept with him and you wanted to punch him in the face after sex, and aren't you mad? She goes, no, I love it. If I see Freddie Stoller, I'll give him a hug. So, and then Norm MacDonald, there was a chapter called Norm Stole My Jacket.
Right.
And Norm asked me to be on his podcast. I said, Norm, I got to come clean. I said, you were a bully. He goes, I don't give a shit. So no one cares. But the people who I didn't think would... And I did things like I had to do, you know, permissions. So the cover had logos of shows. I paid someone to make them a little bit off so I wouldn't get sued.
So this came out as a real book.
That's funny. When people, there's one guy, Ronnie Schell, when you mention it, at the morning table. He used to be on Gomer Pyle.
Yeah.
And this table, they love when people are suffering because Jeff Garlin comes to the table.
Yeah.
And they don't like, I shouldn't say they don't like that he's got another show. So... They go, oh, I heard it's not going to do good in the Midwest.
They love the schadenfreude of show business.
They love when people fail. That has nothing to do with them.
Yeah.
I heard the new Fantastic Four. That's not going to do good.
I see that in show business all the time.
Yeah.
It's just this sort of like negative speculation about things.
And it's nothing to do with them. So this guy, when I had the book, Ronnie Schell goes, self-published, right?
Yeah.
Right? Like he was hoping it'd be self-published. And I go, no, it's sort of a real book, sort of. And
so people can get it.
They can get it.
Yeah, and it's it's got a cover and everything.
It's got a cover. It's on Amazon. It's even in libraries. Someone just on Facebook said they got it at a library.
Yeah.
I haven't made a penny from it, but I don't care. It was 10 years in the making.
What do you mean you got an advance?
Define advance.
No, books are hard, dude.
It was, I was so thrilled. I know we say this a lot, like the money's not important, the labor of love. But I went into a depression 10 years ago when it was getting rejected, because when you're an actor, you get rejected and you're, oh, I'm a New York Jewish accent.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be, you know, a sheriff or a racist. You don't take it personally. But when they're saying, who cares about this guy's life, these agents, it was...
And at that point, you weren't doing stand-up, really.
No.
And
this was my expression.
Right. And some of the work had dried up on you.
Yes.
And this was... writing the book got you out of the darkness?
Well, the darkness came when everyone said, who cares? No, years ago. But then, when the Kindle single did well and the book, it really, it sounds all as a cliche, it was my baby, it was really expressing myself. As a stand-up, I really didn't feel like I was like you expressing myself. I remember I did, when I tried coming back, I did a show and Steve Scroven, who you did a benefit for, go, can't you be like Marc Maron and sit? You sit on a stool and just tell a long story. I can because I'm at Flappers and I'm following guys singing Moni Moni. And you know what I mean? They're drunk. Marc Maron could just sit and talk about Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
So I don't have that. I could, that's why I quit stand up. After 17 years, I came and stopped again.
But the book got renewed interest in your stand-up because I heard that you were doing stand-up.
Well, what happened was people tracked me down. I didn't know there was a Jewish book festival circuit. Did you know that?
There's a Jewish book festival circuit, and I think there's a Jewish comedy circuit. I think Elan Gold does very well on the Jew circuit.
I thought this window would open for me, but it didn't quite happen.
Okay, what happened? So the Jewish book...
So this woman tracks me down. She heard about the book. This thing's what they call imprints? Or what? Yeah. What do they call? Galleys.
Yeah.
She got a galley.
Right.
And she said, we're in Detroit. We're the biggest Jewish book festival thing, the oldest. And I thought, wow, I thought it's going to be like a Comic-Con where Jews from all over, from everything, sit there. So then I was on this circuit...
Yeah.
They asked me to do a few of them wanted me to do my act, like Atlanta, St. Louis, La Jolla.
And when was the last time you did your act?
It was like 17 years before that. So I thought, all right, I got to kind of remember my act.
Did you look at tapes?
I tried that. Then I thought I should try to get in shape a little bit. So I was doing these like little events pushing my book.
Yeah.
Where I sort of thought I was coming up with material. Like I said, like Kathy Griffin, they said, we wish there was more sex. Me too. Then I remembered I had sex with Kathy Griffin. All right, he suffered enough. Give him the book.
Right.
Yeah, it's get a Kathy. Laugh. Yeah, I would get a laugh. Or I would, people, what else was part of the thing? Like, I thought was part of my act where people think I'm rich because they see me on one Seinfeld and they point to the Hollywood Hills. He must live up there. And then I point the hand where I really live. I don't know. Just nonsense.
Yeah.
I thought, all right. I got some jokes, you know, from doing podcasts.
Yeah, yeah.
So then I'd go to these comedy clubs to try to remember my act.
Right.
And it was weird because some of these jokes are 30 years old and they still work. And not the weird morbid one line as I did when I first started, but dating.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm like Three Dog Night.
Yeah.
You know.
Here come the hits, man.
Yeah, like these 30-year-old things.
Play Joy to the World.
Yes. Yeah. I go, and at first I go, I'm having fun because I don't have an agenda. I'm not going to do a Netflix special CD. So at first I go, I quit because I said you can't dabble.
Right.
Then I thought, well, maybe I could dabble again. So this Jewish book festival circuit.
Yeah.
They have Jews that volunteer, and in every city they pick you up at the airport.
Yeah.
And then you have to schmooze with them before the show.
Yeah.
And places like St. Louis or wherever, they're like, they don't look like Jews. We know that like every city had different Jews. Some had athletic looking, tall, Danish looking Jews, lesbian, big Jews picking up at the airport. Yeah. One of them, they had young people because they were like 55 or 60. Yeah. And they're going, hey, how's Howard? Have you met, could you believe Artie?
Yeah.
And so one of them, I told about Kathy Griffin. So this guy was following me around and go, who else? Who else? Go, what are you talking about? Who else you sleep with? I want more. And so at Detroit, some of them came up to me. They go, I'm blind. You haven't done the audio. There were two blind people.
So that experience, it was different than you might have hoped. There was
I kind of liked being flown to different cities. And I could tell stories about dealing with Larry David. And I actually wanted to do the Jewish Book Festival circuit again for the paperback.
Yeah.
So what happened was with the hardback, I was lucky that someone sought me out. But they have this thing where all the Jewish people from Alabama, they're from everywhere.
Yeah.
And they come to this thing in New York.
Right.
And all these Jewish authors, everything, even if they're self-published, do a 2-minute pitch.
Yeah.
And you hope to get
right. It's like a NACA convention.
Yes, yes. So then I said, all right, I'd like to do it for the paperback. Yeah. They said, oh, you got to do the pitch thing. I go, well, don't you know me? I didn't have to do that for the hardback.
Yeah.
They said, no. So you have to pay $600.
Oh, it's a racket.
Put yourself up in New York. And all these Jews are getting flown to New York going, I like him. Yeah. So it's not, I like expressing myself. I love You were the first podcast I went on.
Yeah.
I didn't know what a podcast really was. I feel like my mother, people say, hey, you got to get on WTF.
Yeah. But you psych yourself out, though. I mean, you know, I mean, there is like a certain element to you're not going to, your brain's not going to let you win.
I guess, but I still like expressing myself like this, yeah. Where it's not joke, da-da.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I like it, too. So wait, so you want to talk about the real Kramer, or you do?
It's all right. Yeah, this guy sued me for defamation
for the Seinfeld,
for $1 million.
For the Seinfeld
for the Maybe We'll Have You Back.
But for the Seinfeld section?
Yes, the part that we talked.
So this is the guy that Kramer was based on. What's his name? Kenny?
Kenny Kramer.
Kenny Kramer.
Yes.
So he decides to sue Fred Stoller.
For $1 million.
For what? What'd you say?
Well, I ruined his standing in the gay community.
You did?
That's what he says on the thing. Well,
what was the...
Well, okay, so basically, when in 96, I was in New York, and I needed a place to stay because I didn't want to stay with my mother. I should have stayed with my mother. That would have been less stressful. So he says, you stay with me, but you got to go on my Kramer reality tour as the special guest. He has a bus tour
right. Where
he shows, hey, this is where they bought the cookies.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Right. That's his big racket. That's his payoff for the Seinfeld show.
Yes. Yeah. So I thought, okay. So I was just making jokes because it's true that he had this sidekick running around the bus screaming out expressions from the show. Everyone, the pig, hello, Newman.
Yeah.
And I was writing how the second day in the tour, I was holding my hands to my ears. I couldn't stand the guy running up and down the bus.
Yeah.
And I was begging with Kramer, please let me off the bus. I can't take this.
Yeah.
You know, and I said things like, I was surprised a show like Seinfeld could be so lame down.
Yeah.
You know, because, yeah, you have a 50-year-old guy with a list screaming, not that there's anything wrong with it or whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah.
So then he writes this open letter to me on Facebook demanding a public apology.
For what?
Well, I called him an opportunist.
Yeah,
which we all are.
Yeah,
and so he sues me for calling him an opportunist, and he was just livid because I said Seinfeld was lame down with this bus tour, which yes, that's the probably the biggest show in sitcom history, and a bus tour with a guy running up and down a bus is, I guess I could say, a lamer version.
Yeah,
so you would say this is First Amendment free speech saying. Yeah. You know, and I said things like, whatever.
How'd you ruin his standing in the gay community?
Okay, well, this is... So I said the guy screamed out in the village where the gays are, not that there's anything wrong with it. Come on, not that there's anything wrong with it. So I said he was taunting gays. And it made him look like a homophobe for taunting gays.
Kenny or the other guy?
Well, it was the other guy doing it, but it made him look like a homophobe because the guy.
But you didn't say anything like that.
No, I said.
Said what happened.
Yes, the guy screamed out, "Not that there's anything wrong with it."
And this, so Kenny was just—he just got pissed off, and was
pissed off that I hurt his feelings. Oh. Say,
how did it end?
7 months of litigation.
Oh my God!
Expenses, because he sued the publisher, and we had to write. First of all, he's a. What's it called? A public figure and all this stuff.
Yeah.
So then after 7 months, finally they had oral arguments.
Yeah.
So the judge says to his lawyer, if the supposed taunts wasn't the bus air conditioned with the windows down. So his lawyer goes, what if they're gays on the bus? And then the judge says, wouldn't they know that's an expression from Seinfeld and not that there's anything wrong with it? And then the lawyer goes, that's the worst thing you could say to a homosexual in 2014. So then the judge threw it out.
Yeah.
So then he appealed based on his lawyer never saw Seinfeld. He tried to appeal.
What? That's hilarious.
Yes.
So is it over?
Yes. Unless, I'm just kidding.
So this is all in the book.
Yes.
And the book, you can get it on Amazon, and hopefully they'll have you back on the Jewish book.
You know what's fun? What? The Jewish book, I even on the book tours, I was a guest because I wanted to do the Strand in New York City, you know, big book thing. And they said, all right, we'd love to have you. What celebrity can you get? I go, what are you talking about? They go, well, to bring the people in. I go, but I'm the guy. They go, well, this is the Strand.
Oh, no, so, they really?
Yeah. So then before, Amy Stiller, I know from New York, her dad is Jerry. So then I said, all right, I got Jerry Stiller. They said, all right. And then, so then they called me up, someone in publicity, saying, will you and Jerry Stiller go on some big morning show, afternoon show in New York? And they go, he goes, I could get you on if Jerry comes. So he's co-signing for me. I go, I'm not going to ask him. It makes no sense sitting next to me.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, yeah.
Did you get Jerry to do the event?
He did.
And how was that?
It was a lot of fun. It was a homecoming in New York. He was great. I did.
Nice of him to do it.
It was very, very nice. He,
good guy.
He, yes. Menchie, I learned about getting blurbs.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Ray Romano wrote the foreword. And
oh, it's great.
So it's updated. It's not a 10-year-old book. I put in stuff that, you know, I buffed it up.
Well, I think you're hilarious, and I'm glad you came back, and I'm glad things sort of,
so you get it,
when I would, some ways worked out for you.
So when I would do podcasts, they would end the podcast, maybe we'll have you back, Fred, hee hee hee. You know, so that's a good tag.
You can always come back.
Hey, Mark, I really, again, this is, I hope I wasn't,
no, I love you, man.
All right, because sometimes I'm trying to get all the stories in.
It's all right.
The first time I was on this, I wasn't trying to score. I was just trying to talk.
Well, you know what? It didn't feel like you were trying to score. And you were,
no, first time.
Yeah, no, this time either. It was exciting. And, you know, and I think that people that listen to, if they remember the first time, and I think we're all happy that this thing worked out a little bit. And if you don't want to do stand-up anymore, you don't have to.
I love being conversational. I'll do it. I was supposed to open for Norm MacDonald in Austin, and that would have been fun, me and Norm.
Right.
I have it. Yeah, I still say you can't dabble, and 99% of the comics I know rather do that than anything else.
Yeah.
And I think you kind of got to be that.
All right, Fred. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark.
Oh my God, it always makes me feel better to talk to Fred. Go to his website, get involved with Fred Stoller at fredstoller.net. Will you? Can you? So Jake Kasdan is a good guy. Like I said, I met him once before. We have some common friends. But it's one of those situations where, you know, I'm a pretty huge fan of his father. And I think a lot of you might be. You know what I'm saying? He wrote The Empire Strikes Back. He wrote The Raiders of the Lost Ark. He wrote and directed Body Heat. He wrote The Return of the Jedi. He wrote, directed The Big Chill. Grand Canyon was an interesting movie. He's done a lot of movies that I didn't see, and he's back in business with the Star Wars franchise. But that's his dad. So, you know, part of me is sort of like, what's it like growing up with that guy? So I can't avoid that stuff. But Jake is done, when he was a little kid, he had small parts in a few of his dad's movies. But he was also involved as a director and producer on Freaks and Geeks. You know, he made a couple of movies, Zero Effect. He directed Orange County. He produced, wrote, and directed the TV set. He directed, produced, and wrote Walk Hard, the Dewey Cox story that some people know. He directed Bad Teacher. And he directed Sex Tape. He did some other stuff. But, you know, he's a young guy that's obviously capable and has done some great work. And it was, but you know, there's still part of me that's like, Lawrence Kasdan's your dad. But I'm sure he gets that all the time. But he's a sweet guy. And it's a good story. It's a good career story. It's a guy that sort of had to adapt and learn how to do a lot of different things. And I enjoy talking to the young Mr. Kasdan. As I said earlier, he's the executive producer of The Grinder, which is that comedy that's coming out with Rob Lowe tomorrow night, Tuesday, September 29th, 8:30 p.m. on Fox. So this is me and Jake Kasdan. He's a comic.
Uh-huh.
He lives a comic's life.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he could use it then, maybe.
Well, he could definitely use the car.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's going to give me a couple grand for it. And then part of me sort of like, ah, I'm doing all right. Take the car.
Maybe this is a moment where you give Ryan a car. I get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I hear you.
Yeah, have you had those moments in your life?
I relate to the moment, I guess, and I not that specific moment, but I...
The generosity, Jake. Have you found
it
in your
impulse.
Heart?
It's an impulse. I hear you. Yeah. No,
it's an impulse. So now that might be something I regret.
Maybe no, I don't think so.
10 years down the line when I have nothing, I don't have a pot to piss in.
And you're wishing you had that car back?
Yeah. Wish I had that fucking $2,000. Wish I had that 2006 Camry.
Yeah, either the $2,000 or the car.
So where are you coming in from, man? You're working?
I am. Got a new show that I'm working on called The Grinder.
Yeah.
With Rob Lowe and Fred Savage.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're working on Fresh Off the Boat.
I'm working on Fresh Off the Boat as well. And then New Girl, which I've worked on for years now, is starting to figure out their next season. The writers start working next week.
Explain to me how TV works, Jake, and then we'll move back.
I feel like you know a little, though.
No, I don't pay attention. My manager tells me, like, well, since you're doing this and that, we're going to get you this.
Yeah, oh, no, right. Great. Yeah, and you show up. I get it. Yeah. This one, they've all been a little bit different, but this one and New Girl as well were shows that somebody sent me the script and asked me to direct the pilot. And in both cases, I sort of like loved working on the shows and worked well with the guys who created the show. And in the case of New Girl, it's Liz Merriweather. And on Grindr, it's these guys, Jared Paul and Andy Mogul. In both cases, writers that I had known and been a fan, you know.
But you're brought in as a director.
Brought in as a director and producer.
Right.
And which means different things in different cases. Right. And a lot of times is just sort of, you know, a credit. And
in television.
Yeah. And I've somehow done it in a way where it means that I actually stick around for a long time and help them figure out how to get it going.
But not a showrunner, necessarily.
Not a showrunner. Working with the showrunners.
Okay. Yeah. Like a consultant.
Yeah, but like a consultant who's there all the time.
Like a guy with a job on set.
It's a lot like a guy with a job, that's for sure.
So it's a production. It is an actual producer job.
Yeah, it is like producing
shows. But not
a
writer.
Not writing with them in the room, no.
So you bring to it your
reading everything, watching everything, and
filmic
helping
ideas,
them kind of
construction,
some of that
shooting.
Yes, exactly.
Maybe this isn't funny.
Exactly.
Maybe this character doesn't need to be here.
Does this feel like of a piece with the last thing we did?
Okay.
You know, does it? Is this about anything?
Do we
care whether it's about anything?
You're like the in-house fixer. Where's Jake the fixer?
A little bit sometimes. Which is, for better or worse, that is what it is a lot of the time. You know.
Well, let's go back. Let's track it, because you have a famous name to some of us.
Uh-huh.
To, I think, to movie buffs and perhaps Star Wars nerds.
Yeah, exactly. Certainly to Star Wars nerds, yeah.
Lawrence Kasdan is your father.
Yes.
The funny thing is that I first really learned about him through the first movie, through Body Heat.
Through Body Heat, yeah.
You know, that was like when I was in high school and starting to get into film.
Yeah.
We saw that movie and it was like, holy fuck, man.
Yeah.
It's like a noir. It's like a contemporary noir.
Yeah.
That's when he first started throwing around words like that. Contemporary noir.
Yeah. That's like an insanely cool movie too.
It is a good movie.
It's one that holds up, and it's so good. Yeah.
So you grow up with that guy.
Mm-hmm.
Where were you born?
I was born in Detroit, but we moved out here when I was really young.
Right.
And so that he could start trying to do that work.
And do you remember that? Do you remember the struggle for him, or were you already in? Are your first memories on the set? Being held by Harrison Ford or running up, pushing that boulder, maybe?
Yeah, exactly. Sorry. Do I remember the boulder? I remember when it was starting to happen and the excitement around that, but I was a little kid, you know, and I remember the transition from a little kid's point of view of from nothing going on, like he was working in advertising.
Is that what he did?
And
copywriting?
Mm-hmm. Copywriting.
It's interesting that that's sort of like a creative person's outlet sometimes initially. Like creative people who are either, you know, clever and visually creative, but also like literary, do that.
Yeah. And are frustrated by it.
Of course, I think is a big
part of it, you know. And I think in his case, there was a little bit of like he was kind of willfully doing something that he was frustrated by, knowing that it would help, you know, spur him on to
right.
other stuff.
Oh, really? So he's that guy, like, I need to hate myself good and deep.
I guess he might have had a little bit of that. You know, he needed to
move on.
Yeah, a little. I mean, I think he was, you know, he was very focused on what he wanted to do and he was writing like crazy, but...
Screenplays.
Yeah, screenplays.
And you have a younger brother?
I do.
Now, so you remember when Body Heat opened well, perhaps?
I don't really. I don't really remember that detail of it. I remember when he was making it. I remember like going to visit where they were shooting in Florida.
And meeting William Hurt.
Yeah, I remember that. And
his weird nasal, like, oh, so, well, how's he talk? He's got a very specific way.
He has a very specific rhythm.
Yeah.
Sound, yeah.
That's probably more memorable than the screenwriting and all that stuff is meeting that weirdo.
I remember that. And then, you know, they made a bunch of movies together, so he was kind of around for years. You know?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
At the house?
A little bit. I mean, there were
William's here again.
Yeah.
Why is he outside, Dad? Why is William Hurt outside?
He was initially like the guy who, you know, he was in all the movies that my dad made at that time. Kevin Klein.
Right.
Yeah.
Those are big actors at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
When do you remember, because I'm assuming, you get along with your dad?
We're very close, yeah.
Well, that's nice. You seem like a guy that gets along with his family.
It's a nice thing.
Strikes me as that. Pleasant disposition.
You can tell right away.
Yeah, you can actually.
I'm sure you can at this point. Yeah, you've probably talked to enough people about their family to where they walk in your door, sitting in. I'm sure when the president got here, you probably thought.
I knew that he had a problem with his father. I knew immediately. Well documented.
Looking at him,
Well documented problem with his father. I cheated on that one. But you were, like, I think I mistook. I thought that maybe you were the kids in the bathtub in the Big Chill, but no.
No, that was my brother.
Oh, he got the big...
He got the bathtub.
He got the bathtub scene.
I am in there, but he's the kid in the bathtub in the beginning.
Because you needed a younger kid.
Memorable scene.
Yeah, yes, singing exactly. Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog.
Exactly.
That's how he got his SAG card.
I suppose it is.
And you were in the movie
that
as well?
That was how he finally got his SAG card. Yeah.
It's a long haul for him.
Exactly.
A lot of non-union commercials.
That's right.
For secondary baby food.
Frankly, embarrassing work. Yeah.
So you were in it, though? You were, right?
I was. I have. I'm in the funeral scene. I walk up to Tom Berenger's character and ask him if... for an autograph.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I remember that. I watched the shit out of that movie.
Did you?
Sure.
That's a movie that, like, you can return to every X number of years, and it will have a slightly different...
Right, as you get older.
A little bit. And, you know, as you get older, and then suddenly the characters are younger than you.
You're like, what?
I had that happen once recently. And, you know, you have sort of a
with that movie? Are they younger than us?
They are. I mean, they're like... the
late 30s?
Yeah. I mean, mid-30s. You know?
It was interesting that movie defined a generation's evolution into sort of upper middle-class people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has a lot of stuff in it.
It has a lot
of stuff. It's not easy to dismiss.
No.
Yeah. Now, when you're growing up in with that guy, you know, when does... and he wrote Star Wars after Body Heat, right? Body Heat got him to what? What did he write? Star Wars?
No, actually, it was the other way. He was writing screenplays just like in...
You don't mind talking about him, do you?
Not at all. Oh. No. he was writing screenplays like at night, kind of. And
while he's doing ad work. He's trying to think of slogans.
Exactly.
Catchphrases.
That's exactly.
Jingles, maybe.
That's right. Catchy stuff to say about, you know, paper towels.
Yeah.
And
does he have any to his credit? Is there some...
You know, I don't really know, like...
You never asked him, like...
you can point to, exactly.
But that's a Kasdan.
No.
Larry Kasdan.
That's an early Kasdan. No.
I know you like Raiders, but this thing he did for toilet paper.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's a, you know, it's like a area that he doesn't talk about that much.
You would ask.
Maybe he wasn't that good at it. I don't know. I mean, I feel like people would talk about it if you were there.
I'd love it if he did an A&W campaign.
Yeah.
Something ridiculous. It doesn't exist anymore.
I mean, it was a Detroit-based ad firm, so it was probably car centric stuff.
And I can't believe you haven't asked him. Maybe I'll have him in here.
Yeah, you should, absolutely. But he was like writing screenplays at night kind of thing. And he wrote The Bodyguard. You remember that movie with Costner?
Yeah, and Whitney Houston.
Yeah, he wrote that many, many years before it was made.
Right.
And
for who?
For McQueen.
Steve McQueen. Yeah. Many years. Yeah, yeah.
And I was sort of like on the strength of that. I believe he got the job to, and then another movie called Continental Divide, actually, and it was those two.
What was that movie?
It was Belushi,
right?
And it was sort of like on the strength of those two spec scripts, he was hired to, I believe, I want to say that it was Spielberg's company had bought Continental Divide,
yeah,
and he was hired sort of on the strength of those to write Raiders of the Lost Ark, and worked with those guys, wrote that script with Lucas and Spielberg. Yeah. I guess they had a good time in the course of doing that, and the story, at least as it's been told to me, is he sort
over
of turned
and
it
over
in.
Again.
Exactly. As I've heard ad nauseum. That's not quite, but I've heard it, is that
well,
he turned
you
it
just
in.
Witness the story.
But also you maybe alter it in your head,
sure.
But I think that the thing is that he turned it in.
Raiders.
And basically like that day, Lucas said the person, the woman who was writing Empire Strikes Back, just passed away. And will you do that?
Mm-hmm.
And so he went directly into writing Empire. So he wrote Raiders and Empire Strikes Back like in the space of several months. And
those turned out to be fairly big movies.
Those were popular.
Yeah. Kids liked those movies.
They did.
Yeah.
And then off of those, he went and made Body Heat, and Lucas kind of in a uncredited position sort of helped him
direct,
yeah.
And so he learned how to direct from Lucas on the sly.
Yeah, I guess so. Although I don't know if he was really there, but he was like, he helped make it happen.
Right. Oh, okay. And he went on to write which other Star Wars movies?
And then he wrote Jedi, the third.
Yeah.
And then he had nothing to do with the next set that came out 15 years ago.
Yeah.
But now
he's back.
And
are they going to put that in the credits?
Yeah,
Lawrence
maybe.
Kasdan is back.
He's back. I think that's how they say it at Comic-Con.
At the scribe helm.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was sort of recruited into working on this new set, and then his role in that has gradually increased a little bit, and so he's really involved in that.
So that's exciting for him.
It's really cool, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a wild thing where, like, 30 years later...
Yeah, guess what? We're going back to space.
Yeah, you know? And, like, and people are interested in those movies.
Sure.
People are excited about them, and, you know...
Well, I imagine they're excited that he's back, because he probably represents to them the integrity of the franchise in some way, like from the old days. Like, I imagine there's plenty of Star Wars people that are like, they haven't been good since Kasdan was writing them.
I'm sure there are people who feel that way, and I think that he certainly represents like some continuity to the original movies. I mean, it's not even just representing it. I mean, he is direct continuity to the original movies, you know.
And he's got great sense of story, that guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
now let's move to you. Don't be insulted. When I had Jacob Dylan in here, it was a little more difficult to get him to talk about his father, but
really?
But I asked.
Because
you went into the same racket.
Yeah. And I'm not at all insulted, by the way.
Oh.
I'm not at all happy to talk about it.
Well, I think, you know, what happens, not so much with what you do, but with somebody like Jacob, you know, you're sort of publicly, you know, drawn into comparisons to your father. If you're going to go out with a guitar and be Jacob Dylan, people are going to be like, really?
Yeah, that's a pretty radical example of that thing, too.
No, but it is. And I think that, you know, on some level, in my mind, you know, I don't compare you to, but you think in terms of like, the decisions you make, obviously, as a writer, as a director, you're not as public, and the comparisons are going to be different.
Right.
But there are sort of thoughts of like, you know, did you think about doing something else? Was it easier because he was your dad? But I mean, when did you start realizing that show business was the business you wanted to be in?
Well, I mean, I think that I had this incredible sort of access and point of view from a really young age that let me see what it looked like and what it seemed like. And, it was really attractive, like even when I was a little kid.
Right. How could it not be?
Yeah, I mean, going on set, like, it looked like the best job in the world, you know?
Yeah.
And he certainly reinforced that idea, you know, directly. Like, this is incredibly fortunate circumstance, and, you know, realize how lucky you are, like, even as a kid.
Right.
You know?
To be here, yeah.
Yeah, to be...
Tough game, tough racket.
This is what our life is like.
Right.
And, you know, that we get to, that he got to do that stuff at that time. And I think, you know.
And he paid some serious dues. I mean, he was working, supporting a family, writing scripts at night, probably turning in dozens of scripts.
Yeah.
That didn't go anywhere.
Exactly. And he has, you know, like this, he's got this thing framed in his office that's like everybody who passed on Bodyguard.
Oh, really?
You know, and it's like a lot of people. Yeah. And then, yeah, you know, it's like, so it's, you know, a testament to the kind of persistence of it, which is another, you know, real like lesson and a worthwhile thing to, that I guess I could see close up, you know, that there was, you have to.
No easy route.
Yeah, you got to keep working at it, you know.
You got to keep working. And once you do get your break, you got to deliver.
Right.
On some level, right?
That's another big important part of it.
And your brother's in show business as well?
Because it runs out really quickly, you know? You sort of need to...
The goodwill?
Yeah, a little bit. So after, you know, as much as there is any to begin with, which is a quite, you know, but there's certainly like...
So the jump between, so you're Larry's kid,
yeah,
to like, all right, you did a thing, now you're in.
Yeah, a little bit. It doesn't quite follow to like, you're Larry's kid, I can't wait to see your movie.
You know, it's more
it's
of a, like,
not a direct line.
We got to do something with Larry's kid.
Yeah. It's funny because now I think back on it with like a slightly different perspective, and I imagine, I mean, I think about the things that I'm asked to read, or you know, it. I can't imagine it was like that exciting to read Larry's kid stuff, you know. like I can't imagine that people were stoked that they got that opportunity necessarily on that basis.
What were those scripts?
You know, I mean, I
don't know.
That, like, I mean, I started writing scripts at a certain point, you know, and
how just, old?
I was like, you know, early 20s.
Yeah. Did you go to school and shit?
I dropped out of a couple of different colleges, mm-hmm, and then started basically doing that.
So you grew up pretty much here in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
Bev Hills?
In the Valley initially, and then Beverly Hills when I was in high school.
And you're living that life, Beverly Hills teenager life?
Sort of, but like a probably maybe like a slightly odd version of it.
Oh, yeah? How so?
A little bit. I mean, it was... I went to high school. I finished high school at like a sort of small kind of artsy private school.
The one down in Santa Monica? Which school?
No. My brother, you're thinking of Crossroads.
Yeah.
Where my brother went,
uh-huh,
and where my now wife went.
Uh-huh.
But I went to a different one called Windward that was at the time sort of another one kind of like that.
Yeah.
And and is sort of a slightly different thing now. But it was sort of like a progressive artsy kind of school. And so it wasn't, you know, with a surprisingly diverse kind of student body.
Yeah.
That a lot of whom are still my very close friends, actually. Like, I kept a lot of close friends from high school.
Were these Hollywood kids? People we would know?
That's the thing, is that they weren't mostly. You
but
know,
Crossroads was.
Crossroads was a little sort of more developed and had a little more of that at that time.
Right.
You know, there was a little bit of it, but not that much. And so it didn't really feel like a Beverly Hills life exactly.
Right.
Although I'm sure in many ways it was, but it wasn't, you know, it felt like everybody came from slightly different kinds of worlds,
right,
and the people that I was close to were sort of had a very diverse, you know.
So you weren't running around with the celebrity kids?
No, I wasn't really like running around with celebrity kids that much.
You don't strike me as the party guy.
No, I've never been that guy. It's that obvious.
You strike me as the thoughtful kid that hang around with the delicate ones.
Yeah, I was like, I was the thoughtful one with the delicate ones. Exactly. Just a perfect read.
You didn't want to get hurt.
Maybe still am, which is a... Like, maybe nothing changes from the time you're 15. It's possible.
Well, I think not a little bit. You do sort of find that you're whatever you were with a little more confidence, hopefully.
Yeah.
And a little less anger for me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. A little more confidence and a little more. Although, I don't know actually if I. It's a different confidence. I probably had too much confidence then in some ways. I was very comfortable with my thoughtful...
Delicate friends.
Thoughtful, delicate friends. Yeah, exactly. And then, I think that... I don't know.
You went to college and
like all the same stuff I liked then.
Like what?
I mean, I like the same movies.
Yeah?
I like a lot of the same... Kind of. Like, I loved Bob Dylan then. I don't know.
What about movies? What movies were the ones that made you... Outside of your dad's movies, maybe, that made you want to pursue things in this business?
I mean, I think, I had I was definitely a kid who was just enraptured by comedies of that time, the Bill Murray, Harold Ramis,
right.
Canon, mm-hmm. and then, those kind of movies. But then there was as I got older, I sort of, you start to...
Get a little more sophisticated.
Hopefully a little more. And, as I was kind of really starting to try to do the work, I was more focused on network and all the presidents.
Yeah.
Made.
So you go to college to study what?
Well, I went to college briefly, twice.
What
to
happened?
Study. I just kept dropping out. I was unhappy in the first place and left, and then I went to another place where I thought maybe I would
be
better.
Which places were these?
The first place was Hampshire College.
Sure, hippie school. So you went right from a progressive...
You must go to these places.
No, yeah, the progressive...
I mean, you must play those. Like you,
no, I don't play
Hampshire. Do you play
Hampshire.
Northampton?
No. No? But like, it's funny to me that you go from a progressive...
that was the thing. Was like
school,
but then
high school.
I went to another one, too, because I went to Santa Cruz after that.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I just kept going to these progressive
hippie
schools.
You just never went to
schools.
A real school.
And then didn't like them. So it was like, I didn't learn my lesson. I just kept
clearly,
I kept trying the same thing.
The freedom of not having structure was appealing to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah,
so much so that I eventually abandoned the whole endeavor there was no structure at all.
Did you get a credit for that?
I don't. I think
how do you want to design your education? I want to abandon education.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, so that's your thesis.
That was
leaving
the,
school.
And I really followed through with that.
That's great. They must be proud of you. You should go back and get some sort of
exactly.
Doctorate.
I think it's unlikely. Wasn't that kind of education.
Right, yeah. Right. Like, he's back.
Exactly.
This is the guy that majored in leaving.
Exactly. That's exactly right. I was majoring in leaving.
So, okay, so you get back here and you're just going to put your nose to the grindstone and write shit.
Yeah.
And then, your dad said, I'm projecting everything.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, look, if you put something together, I'll give it to my agent.
Not exactly, but I mean, he wasn't that, he was kind of reading stuff.
For you.
Yeah, and giving me great kind of feedback and a
really?
Lot of how I learned to do that.
Well, let's talk about that. So what was the first script that you said, all right, Dad, I did it. Here's 120 pages of mess that I made.
It was a, I initially, before that, actually had been writing, this will give you a real sense. I was writing plays in high school.
Mm-hmm. Sure, it's
was
a lucrative undertaking.
Yeah, absolutely, especially in high school.
Yeah.
And, so I started doing that really young, and he could be, he and my mother both were a great sort of.
She's
first
a writer
audience.
As well?
She's probably wouldn't call herself a writer, but they have written together a mm-hmm. bunch. They've written a couple of movies together.
Which ones? Accidental Tourist?
No, Grand Canyon.
Oh, yeah.
And a recent movie called Darling Companion.
Okay.
And, but she's a thoughtful person and a great reader, and anyway, in that at that time they would read stuff, and they were very supportive, but also could be strong about, like, this is not really a play because it has no drama, that kind of thing.
That's a parental note.
I mean, you know, maybe slightly more.
You're going a little arty, were you?
Delicately. I don't even think I was. I mean, uh-huh. it was just like learning, or, you know, trying to learn how drama works,
right.
I guess, you know. And so, you know, that it started very young. I had this kind of like conversation going with them that continued into the first few scripts. And there were a couple of like, I'm trying and, you know, would try for a long time to get something to be really good, and had a couple mediocre attempts that were,
right.
You know, probably sort of embarrassing, and then got to one that seemed like maybe there was something to it, and I kept writing that for a long time.
Which one was that?
It was called Zero Effect, and that became my first movie.
Ben
eventually.
Stiller.
Yeah, with Ben and Bill Pullman. That was my
first
movie.
And it did well?
Did not do well.
No.
There's no way to... it was sort of... people liked it enough to where I was able to make a credible case that I could do more of this, maybe.
So that was a big undertaking.
It was a big undertaking.
And throughout the course of writing Zero Effect, you were in touch with Lawrence Kasdan, your father.
I was.
And he helped you in structuring it and directing it as well?
In like locating what the big problem was, kind of in the writing part of it. And
what do those problems look like? Is it like it turns of the story? I mean, is it you got no third act or what?
In that case, it was probably like there's sort of a character comedy central to it, but it's a detective story.
Right.
And the detective story part of it was not totally figured out and took
kinda
a long time to figure out.
You kind of need to have that figured out so it goes somewhere.
Yeah, a little bit. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like has an ending. And
that's tricky.
That. It was tricky, and it took a long, you know, it was like I spent another year working on it or something before.
And once you got the gig... Who produced the movie? Did your father produce it?
No, it was Castle Rock.
Oh yeah, I remember Castle Rock. What was that guy's name? Glenn. He was the TV guy.
The TV guy. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I remember. I remember meeting with him post Seinfeld. He can give a fuck about anything.
They all that Seinfeld was very good for those guys.
What was the other guy's name?
Martin Schaefer was the president of the company, and Rob Reiner. You know, it was his company, and Rob was kind of around as well, and sort of had a, you know, would respond and give notes and thoughts.
So
he was like an early voice as well.
I like his voice. I'd like to hear him giving notes.
Yeah, he was great. He was great.
And he made some good movies.
Like, would watch the movie and suggest that you cut out your favorite scene and like make you talk it all the way through.
You respect his filmmaking?
Yeah, well, Rob, I mean, absolutely. And he had just this incredible run of movies, you know, back-to-back movies that started with Spinal Tap,
right,
which is one of my all-time favorite comedies.
Yeah. And then The Kids, Stand By Me.
Stand By Me. And then
When Harry Met Sally, Misery.
Yeah, Harry Met Sally was right after that. It's hard to think of anybody who's got a first five movies quite like that.
Yeah, and that are that popular and sort of broad in audience appeal.
Varied.
So that was your first movie experience. Mm-hmm. And your father, did he come to set? Did he, you know, did...
They came to visit. At that time...
But what about figuring out your way around the camera and shit?
Well, you know, I'd been around it a lot. Yeah. And I had been around one of his movies, Wyatt Earp, like really closely a few years
because you were old enough to take it in.
Yeah, and I was there for most of that production, and I was like, the idea was that I was like writing a book about the making of that movie.
Uh-huh.
And what ended
how'd that book come out?
Well, what it ended up happening was I wrote this, I sort of put together this kind of promotional thing from these interviews, because I did like crazy amounts of interviews with everyone involved in making the movie, like a lot of like behind the scenes, like the cowboys who take care of the horses
and
that, you know, like this incredibly detailed sort of survey of like everything that goes into making a huge western.
Yeah.
And then I wrote like 100 pages of a book like an actual text about this, like trying to synthesize it into something.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the movie came out and it was sort of like a disappointment. And I think that at that time,
I like the movie.
The movie's great. Yeah. It was to the, what happened with it was disappointing to the people who made it, but it was, you know, movie's really cool.
It's a monster.
And it was, you know, a 7-month shoot. And yeah. It was just this kind of scope that, you know, it's like an unusual thing to be able to see.
You don't see it anymore. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the last of them.
It was right up there. And yeah. That, you know, it's certainly a dying breed a little bit.
Isn't it interesting your father's compulsion to make that was the second Western.
Yeah, it was the second Western.
And in Silverado,
he loves Westerns, yeah. And so did Costner, you know, and they had that partnership. They made a bunch of movies together, and it was just this, but, you know, it was this massive
thing. It's such a film thing.
Yeah.
To sort of take that, you know, I think what it seems like your old man might have liked about story, you know, you could put it all into a very human package with a Western, create these mythic personalities.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, he grew up on them a little bit, and it was just like those guys love cowboy movies, you know?
So you're watching his relationship with the cinematographer.
And I was watching it really closely, and he had the most amazing people working on that movie, too. So it was like, you know, it was Owen Roizman, who was just like a genius DP, who... You know, it shot French Connection and Network, amazing movies. And it was this incredible sort of, you know, I sat there quietly, basically taking notes for like 7 months. And then actually beyond that, all the way through the editing and everything. It was a real...
That was your film school.
It was a little bit of a film school, yeah.
So by the time you got to Zero Effect, you had a certain amount of knowledge. You knew your way around a set.
I did. And I knew what everybody did. And I had some sense of how the kind of mechanism of it worked.
Right.
And, you know, the intention behind things. And then I surrounded myself with really good people was the other thing. And I had, you know, a DP named Bill Pope, who's like a brilliant guy that... taught me a ton about how that worked.
But then you didn't do another movie for years.
For a few years.
Yeah. What'd you do?
I made the pilot for Freaks and Geeks.
How'd you get involved with those guys?
You know, he called me up out of nowhere and basically we had met once or twice through Ben in the course of making Zero Effect. And basically he called up one day and said, there's this pilot that I'm producing and I need someone to come and direct it. And I remember he said, and help me with the music. That was like in his head, that was the hole that he needed filled or something.
Right,
and
right.
And he described it to me. And I had been at that time, it had been about a year since Zero Effect had come out, and I had been writing. I was living in San Francisco mostly at that time. I went up there for a little while right after that movie came out to just kind of like...
Run away?
Yeah, just get out of town for a minute.
Oh, yeah?
Friends and stuff.
Were you disappointed?
You know, initially I was... It was a little bit of a... Yeah, I guess I was sort of like, I was disappointed that it wasn't quite what you imagine as you're making it in terms of when it came out, but it was also like a great experience and I was really proud of it. And it's just the first time you put one of those things out, it usually beats the hell out of you a little bit one way or another.
Why wouldn't it?
And I guess
no matter how you frame it or what you've been through, what your family's been through, there's party that's like, yeah, this is a good one. This is a good movie.
Yeah, you just hope for the best, you know?
Yeah.
And even if you know, as I did, like that it can go any different way, it's still, you know, and the truth is, it's always like that. I mean, whenever you put these things out, you sort of know that it can be any kind of thing.
Yeah, it might
thing.
Be. It's out of your control.
It can be great. It can be brutal.
Right.
It can be, you know?
Yeah.
So I went up
to... Was it well received by critics?
Basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. I mean, it had been, I had no legitimate complaints about right. anything. And I kind of knew that too. You know what I mean? Like I had I knew exactly what it was, sort of, you know, like
right.
that I had
right.
gotten to do this thing. It was all I had wanted to do. It was thrilling and all of that, you know,
and
but
yeah,
then
yeah.
you got to do it again. So it's just like, and I think that there was, I'd been working on it for a long time at that point, and I was just kind of like resetting and wanted to see, you know, some friends who lived somewhere else, kind of, and
yeah,
be somewhere else for a minute.
Seek refuge with the thoughtful, delicate people.
Exactly. I'd lost track of the thoughtful, delicate people, and I needed to find them. And where were they?
San Francisco.
They were in San Francisco, the, yeah. obviously. Yeah,
yeah, they were
exactly.
they were dropping out in a different way. That's where they are.
Exactly.
That town's built for that.
That's, exactly.
That's where you graduate to.
They felt like they had finally found the right place.
They probably had.
Exactly.
And then Judd calls you up to direct and pick music.
He called me up and asked me if I wanted to direct this pilot. And he described it to me over the phone and described the opening with the Freaks and Geeks pilot opens with like, you know, in the bleachers of a football game, it's like a cheerleader and a jockey guy
yeah.
kind of like having an overwrought, very emotional sort of typical high school television show conversation about their relationship. And then the camera like drops under the bleachers and you meet the like freak dirtbag guys who the show's actually going to be about.
Right.
And then you sort of like get into their conversation and then swing over to the geek kids who are like, you know, reciting dialogue from Caddyshack to each other.
Right.
And then get confronted by a bully. And I just thought it was like in that description. I mean, he probably said about that, you know, it just sounded, I loved it. And I loved talking to him about it kind of, and basically said right in that moment, like, yeah, sure. You know, and I hadn't worked in television before and didn't really know that much about it. And it was something I was interested in, and kind of on a whim decided to do it. And then they sent me Paul's script and it was great. But I mean, all this happened in about 36 hours and it was just sort of like, yeah, sure, why not? And it ended up being this experience that kind of
changed
a lot of what followed, you know,
yeah,
so
yeah.
it still impacted a lot of
so
my
life. So you directed that
since.
Pilot.
Mm-hmm. And then four other ones. So I directed about a third of it.
Yeah.
And
great guy, great
and
people
was
to work
there
with.
The whole time, you know, like stuck around. It was the first show that I directed the pilot and then ended up sticking around kind of.
And that's become sort of what you do.
Yeah, it's one yeah, of the things I do. Yeah.
Jake will
sure.
hang out.
He's he does the pilot. He'll stick around forever.
He likes to hang out.
A little bit,
just
yeah.
Just give him a producer credit. He'll fucking hang out.
Just he'll do whatever the thing is. He'll probably go do it. Whatever you might least want to deal with, he'll probably run down there and do it.
But so that was an amazing experience because, you know, that crew, a couple who I've talked to has gone on,
yeah.
as you have, to do amazing things and continue working from that juncture forward.
It was an amazing thing. I mean, it was just this, you know, that you kind of couldn't have anticipated, really.
And yeah.
Just if you would have projected to now from then,
where everybody would be,
and described it to everybody, you would sound insane.
Well, the people that
all
like,
three guys will be, you
right.
know, bankable leading men.
Right. Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's just like, and Seth Rogen will be the first. You know, I mean, it was, you know, I mean, everybody involved because has kept going, and it was certainly the other side of the coin of my. It was the other major formative experience.
And also that show is pretty filmic. It's not a three camera
yeah,
box.
No, that's right.
So it, you know, it was more in your wheelhouse anyways coming into it.
It was, and I think that maybe that is something that I helped bring to it almost without knowing, because it was just that was sort of the look and feel that I knew and related to, and it felt like was right for that thing. But there was also just this huge learning curve at that moment.
About what?
About comedy, you know, about like a classic kind of comedy process, a joke-oriented comedy process.
Really?
Yeah, that I
because
didn't
that's
really
sort of sublimated
that.
In that anyway as well. I mean, that's not again, it's not an audience show. It's not the comedy is very. It comes from an organic place. You're not doing joke to joke.
It's not punchy in the way that certainly a lot of those people, their subsequent work has been. But it was definitely a world where it had to be funny, and if something was funny, it was going in the show. That would be enough to get it in the show. It's a way of thinking about whether something's scoring and making check marks in a script and all of that, sort of like, because Judd really did come from, as is well documented, a kind of strict comedy background.
Right.
And I was really interested, but just didn't know anything about that,
So that's really what you had to learn.
And it was a big thing,
Do you remember?
It affects every aspect. And also, the idea that they could improvise, the idea that you could depart from the script and what happens might be better.
Right.
That you could shoot alternate jokes. And part of it was me sort of trying to figure out how to build a system for doing that stuff that kind of allowed for that room.
As a director. Yeah.
And then I think a lot of what we together figured out about how that would work has informed a lot of what a lot of us have done since,
Sure.
In terms of like, how can you shoot something in sort of a filmic way that feels like a movie, but has that kind of looseness to it. And
all of you have done it. All of you have directed pretty big comedies. I mean, you have Judd, Paul, you.
Yeah.
And I guess Ben was off doing the Stiller Show at that time, right? During Freaks and Geeks, or was that?
Yeah, Ben was not involved in Freaks and Geeks, except that he came to do a sort of because we could feel the axe coming down on Freaks really almost the whole time it was on the air. And
just because of viewership?
Yeah, the ratings were terrible. And we didn't really, it had fans for sure, but there was just a strong sense with the way the network would talk about it that it was not going to last very long. And as sort of a last-ditch effort to, trying to come up with everything we possibly could to be able to keep making them, Ben generously came and did like a cameo in what in retrospect seems like a fairly forced kind of story idea, which is that he was playing a Secret Service agent.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
In the accompanying the vice president to speak in the auditorium of their school. But he was really, really funny.
And then when you started to do the bigger movies, I mean, what was it? After Freaks and Geeks, you did...
Right after Freaks and Geeks, I did the pilot for Undeclared, which was Judd's next show.
The sort of like the follow-up, yeah.
The follow-up. And then was going to do my standard hang-around thing.
Yeah.
And I instead got a call to make Orange County, which had been written by Mike White, who was a writer on Freaks, and I knew from there. And
that's
Scott
the way it
Rudin works. Was making that movie
with the Hanks kid, and that movie was popular. That was a good movie.
It was somewhat popular.
Yeah,
it was popular enough.
And then then you start making movies. So now you're making movies.
Well, I was always sort of bouncing back and forth.
Which is not a bad place to be.
I continued to do sort of both things a little bit. And after Orange County, there was a little period of figuring out the next thing. And then I ended up writing scripts that didn't totally pan out and stuff. And then I wrote a movie called The TV Set that's like about the television business.
I saw that. I saw that one.
Did you?
It's like a satire.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
The inspiration for it, somewhat counterintuitively maybe, had been the watching the sort of unraveling of John Kerry in the presidential campaign, and which felt like this very acute case of the crapification of everything, where this some really worthwhile guy just sort of gets chipped away at by this process. And that,
a very well-funded process of character assassination.
A little bit, yeah. The character assassination and, the screwiness of that. And somehow from that frustration, I started writing about this other thing that I knew much more closely. And we originally intended that to maybe be like an improvised movie, mm-hmm. possibly, but then ended up just writing it and put it together, very small.
But then you did Walk Hard, which is a big movie.
Then I did Walk Hard with Judd.
He was producing and he brought you in?
I had that idea. He had called me up and because part of Judd's sort of genius is that at exactly the moment when he could first sort of anticipate what was about to happen with him, and mm-hmm. he really did sort of anticipate it in a way that I've never quite seen anyone do, which yeah. was right at when 40-Year-Old Virgin was coming out, he called his friend, sort of, and said, if you've got anything you can think of, let's get a bunch of stuff going, basically. And we were, we had remained close in the time yeah. since Freaks.
Right.
And one night, you know, partly in response to all of the, like, biopics, there had been a few of these kind of big, very important, yeah. elegantly made biopics with, you know, that always sort of feature these, like, a staggering performance yeah. at the center of it.
yeah, yeah.
And, but have sort of this very, you know, the kind of like trappings of the important biography sort
yeah,
of movie.
Right.
I had this idea to make like a fake one,
right.
sort of like in like a Ben Stiller show-esque, you know, with a lot of sort of filmic veracity, that it would be this kind of crazy over-the-top journey biopic about right. a fictional musician who, you know, goes through everything all the way to 11,
yeah.
all of them combined, every musical style. And also, you know, I love music, and I am, a lot of my friends are musicians, and my wife
is a
musician.
There's an original score on that, right?
Original soundtrack.
Yeah.
It had, you know, where we tracked 40 original songs with John Reilly,
yeah. who
played the character, Dewey Cox, John singing the songs. And it was, so we spent like, I mean, something like 8 months writing these songs and working with songwriters, who a lot of whom were friends of mine.
You feel it. I mean, it's a big, fun movie.
It's definitely like no group of people has ever worked harder for such an unbelievably silly idea, kind of. And it was, it was this years-long process.
Right.
And John was the perfect person to do it, because
yeah.
he can really sing, and yeah. he's just like an amazing actor.
Yeah.
And so he,
great.
You know, could do it.
Right.
And could actually be cast in a movie like the ones we were kind of
yeah,
parodying,
exact, sure.
you know?
Yeah.
And just put everything he had into it. So it was like we all really kind of like left it on the floor in the most insane way for this ridiculous movie. And it was like this really fun couple of
and
years.
And it got a rollout, like one of those. They you know, all the promotion
yeah,
for
no,
it.
Yeah, no, I mean, maybe it might have bit us in the ass a little bit, but we definitely were very into, and Judd,
You satirized what you were doing, the thing you were making fun of all the way through.
Yes,
promotionally
exactly.
and every
all the
other way,
way. The ads, the trailers, the,
yeah.
you know, Judd somehow got them to do like a parody of an Oscar campaign for John and stuff. So it was like, you know, it would be like him running down the street in a diaper.
Yeah.
It was just like looking just overwrought and dramatic, kind of. And
he's a good sport with comedy.
Oh yeah, I mean, he was awesome, you know.
Yeah. So that was that like the high point of the fun you've had in show business?
Right up there. That was I don't know if anything's ever been more fun than that. I've had some really fun ones, but that was a really fun movie to make. And again, like with, you know, this didn't really work commercially, but it was this sort of crazy thing. And then as soon as it doesn't, you kind of look at each other and you're like, well, of course it didn't. I remember, like, my wife said at the time, like, what'd you think was going to happen? It's like the weirdest, you know.
What do you
idea.
Mean, what'd you think was going to happen? Then everybody would like it.
Yeah, you think everybody's going to like it. You know, and it's one of these movies that, like, people return to and we hear about and we all still hear about it.
Uh-huh.
And also, like, rock stars end
they
up seeing it on the bus and
yeah.
we end up hearing about that, which is great, too. Like, a wide array of people
they relate
that
to it, getting, they love
you know,
it.
And we'll approach John various places.
It's a cult
John.
Movie.
Yeah, it's like its own little thing, you know.
Did Bad Teacher do all right?
Yeah, it did. Good. It did. Yeah. Did well, and it was a one that we had. You know, it was just a really funny script that these guys, Lee Eisenberg, Jane Sibnitsky, had written, and I thought it again. I mean, that's a sort of the inverse thing where I just thought this was a really fun little movie that you could do.
Right.
I just thought it was a really funny script, and then, you know, and kind of weird and dark, and then it ended up being this kind of commercial movie, you know, like a summer comedy, which I hadn't. Yeah, it was great. No
good experience for you.
It was a great experience. It was fun with them. It was the first time I'd worked with Cameron, and that was a great, great thing.
Jason was in it too.
And Jason was in it, and it was the first time that we had worked together in the time, you know, since
Freaks.
Freaks. I mean, we'd remained in touch and were friends and everything.
Sweet guy.
Really good guy. Just one of the best.
And then you do some more TV, and then you do the sex tape movie, which was Jason as well. Yeah. How'd that do?
Didn't do so great.
Hmm.
Got our ass kicked on that one. You never know, man. That's the thing. It's like you can get your ass kicked on any given day, you know?
But you seem to be, like, is it because, it seems to more, the ones you had a great deal of personal investment in, which would be, you know, Zero Effect, TV Set, and Walk Hard, that, you know, you appreciate what they were, and you're able to put it in the context, and the other ones are sort of like, you know, jobs that either go one way or the other.
You know, I get fully immersed. So,
but writing something and directing
is different. It. Yeah, totally. Writing it and directing.
But you seem to fare pretty well with it. Like, you're not, it doesn't seem like you're too beat up by the degrees of variation in the success of these movies or TV shows. You just, is it because you are able to sort of frame it as part of the job?
I think that it's, you know,
or are you hiding something from me?
No,
do you go home and yell at the wall?
I mean, when a movie comes out, it's either kind of like you made it through and you can be happy about that, or you feel like it's like you got in a car accident. And I've had that happen a few times, you know.
Right.
I've had both things, and I've had it with the TV shows too, where it's like something can sort of catch for whatever reason,
right,
and maybe not, and you don't really have that much control over it,
right,
and when it doesn't go the way you want it to, you feel it much more than you do when it goes well,
right,
you know.
Yeah
if you keep enough stuff going, and then hopefully you're able to continue doing the work, which is the main thing. I definitely like feel it when it's hard, you know, and can get knocked down.
Yeah.
But I do feel like, you know, there's sort of a basic perspective that you try to keep in.
Is this something you learned from your father? You know?
I think so. I think it's partly something that I learned from my father, although he has taken his hits as well.
But that's what I mean. How does he handle it?
He can get down, and I think part of it is you see that, and so you know that it's there. And
it's so much time invested in these things.
Yeah. You know, then you also just have a little bit of a, I mean, it sounds trite, right, maybe, but it's just, you're lucky to do it, and I think that.
So that stuck with you.
Yeah, a little bit, and you know, it did. I try to hang on to that. You know, when I was making my first movie, as I was in the middle of, I guess I'm allowed to say this, but as I was in the middle of making my first movie, he's talked about it. My brother got very sick, and he had Hodgkin's disease, which is, you know, they always say like the most treatable, that's the cancer you want.
Right.
Which was still, you know, shake you to your bone, kind of terrifying at the time.
Yeah.
And it was right while I was like in pre-production on Make Zero Effect. And there was something about that I really do feel that has truly stuck with me, which is, you know, the best, most exciting phone call you ever get could be separated by 10 minutes from the most terrifying phone call you ever get that will make everything else in your world seem incredibly small.
That your brother has cancer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, he was then treated, and he's, you know, now I knock wood every time I talk about it, but it's been a long time that he's been healthy. And
you guys are close?
And we're really close.
Yeah.
And I think that it, I mean, we're really close. Like, we talk all the time, you know. And I think that you need to have access to the part of you that remembers that a little bit.
Perspective.
Yeah, you know, because you you can get wound up in this. And the work is, like you say, it's, you know, you can get lost in it a little bit. And it's a lot of time and it's a lot of energy. And you can take stuff personally, but you do have to sort of keep some access to just, you know,
some
sense of scale. Yeah.
Scale and what's important. And, you know, it sounds like, you know, your family's tight.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're making a living. You're doing
all
right.
That's exactly right. And the main thing is continuing to do the work, which I love. You know, it doesn't mean that I can be tough on myself about what I'm working on sometimes. And, you know, like, it's been too long since I've made a movie.
You.
It's been... No, not exactly like it's beneath me, but like it's like...
What am I doing?
Am I swinging hard enough,
right.
Kind of? You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like,
When you're doing a lot of TV...
Yeah.
...of a certain kind...
You can feel it a little bit.
You're like,
exactly.
When am I going to write a movie?
Yeah, you feel like... And then, you know, you can get all the way down the road on a movie and go like... Is this what am I doing here? Is this the right thing?
Am I going to be out of TV jobs if I stay?
You can have some kind of massive insecurity about whatever it is that you're working on,
sure.
You know? And, but yeah, I mean, you know, I'm certainly go through all of that, you know, process about sort of neurotic process about,
hard
about
on
the
yourself.
Work. But,
yeah.
But I do love doing it, and I'm, you know, you try to keep in touch with that, I guess. And, you know, the TV stuff gives you a great opportunity to continue to hone various skills, which I really love.
No, absolutely.
And work with incredibly funny people.
And like it's interesting that, you know, you are able to do both.
Yeah.
And you've done big budget movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, you continue to work as a TV director and then go do a big budget movie, whether it fares well or not.
Yeah.
That eventually, Jake... When the moment comes,
yeah.
When you've got the idea,
yeah, exactly,
that's gonna
maybe
it's gonna
we'll
just fucking knock it out of the park. You're gonna be so on top of that shit.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, you definitely know that, like, when you one big thing, and this goes back to the freaks thing, is like, you just never know what you're gonna decide to do one day that's gonna end up affecting the next many years of your life. And I've had this experience with television a lot, where you find some major collaboration that I would put up there with anything, you know, and it's like, that's where I met Judd, that's where I met Siegel, you know, Liz Merriweather I work with on New Girl, we're years into that now, and that's like a great thing that, you know, has had a lot of different, you know, she kind of has helped me out on other stuff. And,
yeah.
You just never know where these things are headed, you know? And
sure.
You,
yep.
So I take it all for, try to figure there's usually something good in there.
Okay,
know?
Well, the question, are you working on a movie?
A little bit. Yeah, I'm trying. I mean, right now I'm in deep on these shows, though, for the fall.
Well, yeah, Jesus, you got The Grinder and you've got the...
It's potentially a 60-episode
Fresh
year.
Off the Boat, right. So you're in for TV for a little while.
For this year, I'm in deep, yeah, you know.
Focused.
Kind of, yeah, I try to just keep it all in your head. And
yeah, but do you make notes sort of like, like, okay, this is a scene. Like, you
I
know,
continue to write a
you've
little,
got the,
you know?
The framework of the film in your head, and just like a scene will pop out sometimes or what?
Or more like an idea, and then the framework is like the last thing to fall
all
into
right.
place, sort
all
of.
Right. All right. Well, yeah. I mean, well, fucking, you know, good luck with the work.
Hey, man, thank you.
It's good to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you. Can I say one thing to you?
Yeah.
I think you are the best talker to people going.
Thank you.
It's true. I mean it. I will tell you honestly, I've had this commute for years, and there was this moment 2 years into it where I started listening to your show a lot.
Yeah.
And it was like a great moment.
Oh, good.
Yeah, it was like a thing where it was like, and it's partly because you've talked to everybody and you've talked to them great, but there's just this kind of humanity to the whole thing. You get to something with people that makes everybody feel human and highlights the connectedness of people in a way that I really do appreciate and admire, and I love the show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. How do you feel about our conversation? You all right?
That was, oh yeah, it was great. It's all right for you?
Yeah, it was great. I'm glad we did it.
I don't know. I don't know how interesting it'll be to whoever, but that's not my that's not mine to judge. You,
I think you will judge.
It'll be interesting to people who are interested in this.
I think the journey is always interesting, especially when you know what's interesting to me about talking to somebody like you is you know, sort of that a lot of times people in show business or people outside of show business make these assumptions about families who continue to work in show business generationally.
Yeah, sure.
And the truth of the matter is, a lot of times it's no different than any other job.
Yeah.
That you know you grow up in something and your father or your brother or your mother, whatever, they work in this thing, and you look at it and you learn it.
Yeah.
And despite whatever level anyone operates on, I think what was interesting about talking to you is that, you know, you look at your father's track record and there were some hits and misses, but he's a very thoughtful screenwriter, and he's high minded and he takes risks.
Yeah.
And then to sort of learn about your evolution in growing up in that and how he had an effect on you and seeing your ability to sort of move through your own processes is pretty amazing. And then on top of it all, your dad's like back in the Star Wars game.
Yeah.
And it's sort of exactly what you're talking about. So whether you know it or not, your weird kind of practical optimism about being open to collaborating and new experiences and not becoming cynical about your own career in any way, despite whether you love what you're doing or not on the level of the actual product.
Yeah,
is a testament to working hard and having a good point of view about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I usually love it for enough time to do it fully.
No, you don't seem like someone who hates what you're doing.
No, yeah. Never. Yeah. Never. I'm never working on anything I hate. I think that I do have probably something I got from him, and probably something that you relate to on some level, I'd imagine, which is a sense of you hope to be building some larger thing.
Look, I'm 100% in support of the day Jake breaks out. I'm with you on that. I'll be here for you when it happens.
Even the little stuff, though, you know, it's that you're building a body of
you
work.
Have to look at it like that.
You think of it like what you're worried about on any given day.
It's all
will fit into some.
Of course, it's
puzzle
all
of
the
your
experience
life.
Of doing the work.
Yeah.
Is going to. You know, add.
Yeah, exactly.
There's nothing.
Right.
Nothing can take away from unless you shut down and turn part of yourself off. You know, the part of you that part of you that you talk about that I can hear right underneath your throat. That where you're sort of like, I'm gonna do the thing. I gotta do another thing.
I love
soon.
That I'm like completely transparent. I mean, again, you just sit with enough of that. What was sitting directly beneath the president's throat?
Why am I doing this? Good to talk
it's
to you.
Great
man.
Talking to you, man.
Sweet guy, good talk. Has a career in show business. That's a real career in show business right there, people. Go to WTFpod.com, get that Howl app for Android and everything else. Get in there and register to win a thing, a piece of my garage. Get on the mailing list. Check the episode guide. See who's been on. I do field those questions. Get some justcoffee.coop over there. Oh, my God.